Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Lee Steinberger is renowned as one of the greatest sports agents in history and the first prominent one to impress upon his clients the need to give back to their communities. From his unlikely start in 1975 until his devastating fall from grace in the early 2000s, he was the sports agent. At one stretch in his career, he was the agent for 6 overall number one picks in the NFL draft in a 7-year period, and his total number one picks he represented in his agent career is a mark unmatched in the league's history. He was on top of the world, and then he lost it all. This is also a story of redemption, which he tells in the new book, The Agent, My 40-Year Career Making Deals and Changing the Game. It's a pleasure to welcome Lee Steinberg to the Roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
At what point did you know that now was the time to write this book?
It struck me that I now am getting relaunched, and we're going to do representation in the major sports. That will lead to marketing. And in the new world of agentry, it also involves sports-themed motion pictures, television, video games, working on the concussion issue. And so it really is the time to talk about where I've been. And since I sort of withdrew from the world for a couple of years, let people know what's happening, it was also the time to try and reaffirm some basic principles, such as athletes can be role models if they retrace their roots to the high school, collegiate, and professional community and set up programs that enhance the quality of life. We've had 112 high school scholarship funds. At the collegiate level, it's Warren Moon repaying his scholarship at UW, or Steve Young at BYU, or Troy Aikman and Eric Karros at UCLA, a way of linking back in with that community. And then at the Pro City, we've challenged them to find a cause in life that the athlete would like to tackle, and then put a foundation together to make a difference. And for work done, it's been Homes for the Holidays, where he sends 131 single moms into the first homes that they'll ever own and makes a down payment and Home Depot outfits it. So there were some issues from concussion to the right way to do agentry that I wanted to talk through and also to talk about my own recovery.
Let us talk a little bit about what got you in this game. And I mentioned 1975 as a starting point. What was it that brought you into this field initially of wanting to be a sports agent?
Well, I couldn't grow up that way because there was no sports law. I always thought I'd be in court and a criminal attorney. I was a dorm counselor in an undergraduate dorm at UC Berkeley in the early 70s. I had been student body president when Reagan was governor, and we had some famous confrontations. So I went on to law school, and they moved the freshman football team into my dorm. One of them was Steve Bartkowski. And in 1975, he became the very first player picked in the first round of the draft, and he asked me to represent him. Well, there I was, brimming with legal experience, never having practiced before. And the World Football League competed. We were able to get the largest rookie contract in NFL history, and it eclipsed Joe Namath and O.J. Simpson, who were the previous standard bearers. So we fly back to Atlanta to sign the contract the next day, and when we get to the airport, there are Klieg lights flashing in the sky. A huge crowd is pressed up against the police line, and the first thing we hear is we interrupt. Johnny Carson show to bring you a special news bulletin. Steve Bartkowski and his attorney have just arrived at the airport. We switch you live to them. Well, I looked at Steve like Dorsey looked at Toto when they got to Munchkinland, and I said, I guess we're not in Berkeley anymore. And it was really then I saw the intense idol worship and veneration that athletes were held in across the country, how they were the movie stars, celebrities. And that's when I thought, my dad had two core values. One was to treasure relationships, especially family, and the second was to try to make a positive difference in the world and help people who could not help themselves. So I saw athletic representation as a tool to do that, because when I had Lennox Lewis cut a public service announcement that said, "Real men don't hit women," it could do more to trigger changes in rebellious adolescents' attitudes towards domestic violence than 1,000 authority figures. But again, at the beginning, a owner like Mike Brown could just hang up the phone when you call to represent a player, say, "I don't deal with agents," click.
Mm. What do you think, at the height, what do you think made you a good agent? That you were able to have so many top names and really be at the top of the profession?
It really is a matter on an individual basis of understanding the values and priorities of a person on a deeper level. So how do they feel about short-term economic gain, long-term economic security, the geographical location, the ability to be a starter, being on a winning team, the quality of coaching? That constellation of values will fit differently into different people's lives. So the first job, because men don't share so easily, is to find a way to peel back the layers of the onion with a young man so that I can understand his greatest anxieties and fears and his greatest hopes and dreams. And then understand that part of my job is to prepare that person for second career. So three of our players, work done in Atlanta, Ray Childress in Houston, and Daron Cherry, have all been minority owners of teams. And you look at the Steve Youngs, who has already sold a computer company, or Bruce Smith, who's owns part of a luxury hotel, and then the people in broadcast. Part of the goal is, can you get a player to be an outstanding role model, have an outstanding career, and then transition smoothly into a happy life?
You have often been credited for being the inspiration for the character Jerry Maguire. You write in the book that it wasn't so much that you were the inspiration, but you certainly did help fill in some of the blanks for the author of the film and help work on what that life is like.
So Cameron Crowe called me up, the writer-director, in 1993, and asked if he could follow me and pick up atmosphere for a movie based on a sports agent. So he went with me to the 93 draft, where I had Drew Bledsoe as the first pick, up to the press conference with Bill Parcells, to a series of games, to the league meetings in 1993, to my Super Bowl parties twice, to everywhere I went. And I told him stories, lots and lots of stories. And so he went off, wrote the script, and then I had to vet the script to make sure that the willing suspension of disbelief necessary to hold you into a motion picture without feeling it's phony or lampoonish didn't get broken. They invaded my office. They took my pictures off the wall and put Jerry Maguire's head on my shoulders. They took shots out the window. They tried to replicate parts of my wardrobe. And then I took Cuba Gooding Jr. with me down to the Super Bowl in Phoenix and made him pretend he was a wide receiver for a week to put him into role. I actually had to show the quarterback in that film, Jerry O'Connell, how to throw a spiral, because he had gone to NYU and they didn't have football. So there's a lot of life there up on the screen.
And it's safe to say that where the famous line "Show me the money" has been, a lot of people have taken credit for it. That ultimately, that is a phrase that you had heard as your time as an agent prior to the film being made.
Well, what happened was, we had bannered about, but Tim McDonald, who ended up a strong safety for the San Francisco 49ers, was going from team to team, and Cameron was watching the process of free agency. One night they go upstairs in Tim's room, and Moneyline with Lou Dobbs is on in the background. And Cameron asks Tim, what is it you're looking for in this free agency search? And Tim gestures towards the screen, and he says, so I'm looking for a team to show me some respect. I'm looking for a team to show me some victory. I'm looking for a team to show me economic security. And Cameron wrote, show me the money.
Mm. As I mentioned in the introduction, much of this story is about, is a redemption story as well. And you lost a lot in this. There was bankruptcy, there was alcoholism, divorce, a costly divorce settlement. A lot came together at one time, one period of your life. Without casting blame, and you certainly don't do that, but I'm curious as to whether you think that a large amount of success in a short period of time helps that along.
Well, since I was sort of 35 years into my career, it really was not work-related because I love what I do, and I got a great deal of satisfaction, and I love the frenetic lifestyle. In the 2000s, there were a series of personal reverses. My father died a long, ugly death of cancer. Then I had a diagnosis that my two kids had an incurable eye disease. Then we lost a home to flooding and had to demolish it. And then ultimately, my marriage broke up. And I felt powerless, like Gulliver on the beach, tethered down, being stuck with pitchforks. And I turned to alcohol, not a very constructive way to deal with it. And in 2007, 8, and 9, I spiraled down. And by 2010, I realized that alcohol was controlling my life. And I had an epiphany, a moment of clarity, that I wasn't living up to either of my father's admonitions, and this couldn't be how I was supposed to live. So I gave my practice to the younger players and went into sober living. Much of the bankruptcy came because of judgments that came when I was just default judgments where I was focused on getting sober and just didn't go to court. So I surrendered to the concept. I worked a 12-step program. I joined a unique fellowship and decided, if nothing else, I would be sober and I would be a good father. So that was 4 years ago, and in March we hit my fourth sober birthday, and now I'm back to try and make a difference in the world.
How much of it do you want back in the sense of you spoke at the beginning of our conversation about many of the great things that you're doing and things that are part of your agenda. Is part of that agenda to be an agent again, to be active, to have the top players being represented by you?
Well, I think ultimately I don't want to replicate my past or compete against myself. I mean, no one's going to do eight top picks in the draft again. It's sort of an act against nature. And I wouldn't want to have a practice of 90 football players. We had very dominant baseball players, basketball, Lennox Lewis, Nasir El-Hoy, and boxing. I don't need to be anywhere near that type of volume. If I can help one player or a small series of players, and we can go ahead and do what we've done before, that'll be enough. And then our business has morphed towards content supply and sports theme motion pictures, television, video games. I have work still to do on the concussion issue. I believe that it's an existential threat to football. It's a ticking time bomb. I've held 6 conferences on the subject. I've called it, again, an undiagnosed health epidemic. And I now believe that the very act of an offensive lineman hitting a defensive lineman at the inception of every football play creates a low-level concussive event. So you could have an offensive lineman walking out of football with 10,000 sub-concussive hits, none of which had been diagnosed, none of which he's aware of, but the aggregate of which is a much more impactful damage on the brain than getting knocked out three times. So we urgently need helmetry. There's a new helmet through Tate Technology that does more than the current protection against skull fracture. It attenuates the energy wave and dissipates it through compression. We need nutraceuticals and pharmaceuticals that can prophylactically protect the brain or help it after. Kids have to be taught proper blocking and tackling techniques young. We need better diagnosis on the sidelines. So that's an important issue.
There are those who say that kids shouldn't be playing tackle football until they're 13 or above.
Everyone has to make that decision personally. I will tell you that the young brain is at a higher level of risk for two reasons. Number one, it's still developing and needs to be able to develop without being traumatized. And number two, it takes three times longer for someone young to recover than someone older. And those kids still have to go to school. So it's a personal choice, but you have to be really careful with that process. So football urgently needs to deal with this, because if you have 30% of mothers telling their boys you can play any sport but not tackle football, it won't destroy football. It'll just change the socioeconomics of it so that the same sort of people who play it are the people who box. They know that there are high risk of brain damage, but they see it as a ticket out of economic distress.
The NFL has started to address the issue, and it is starting to listen to the calls that you and many others have made over the years. I guess my question is, going forward, do you think it really is going to be an economic issue that is going to fall in the hands of agents such as yourself and the union to make sure that there is protection to these players?
I think that the NFL is aware of it and needs to take action, because, first of all, the judge in the large lawsuit just set the verdict aside, or the award aside, so there's that pressure. The NFL can never allow that lawsuit to come to fruition, because it's pretty clear, if you read Liga Denial, that they did their own tests, knew that the concussion issue was real, knew there was heavy risk and damage, and yet Elliot Pelman, the league doctor, told the players there is no concussion issue. There's no risk for the long term. One doesn't lead to another. And called me a fearmonger in Sports Illustrated. I had a crisis of conscience back in the 80s, because I watched these players, and intuitively you had to know. When doctors told us, we can't tell you how many is too many and the rest, I couldn't just stack dollars into the bank book of players and think I'd done my job if they were going to go on and get dementia. So it really gets down to what a real fiduciary responsibility is, what is conscionable to do in the world, and really caring about players.
So given what we've been talking about, given what you have gone through, and given your current status in this sports world, how do you go in and watch the Super Bowl that's coming up, for example?
Well, we hold one of the biggest parties at the Super Bowl, and I'll do it this year for the 26th time. The Super Bowl has become a convention of Americana. Big business, big politics, big sports, big entertainment, all together in the same city. Party after networking after event. And, oh, coincidentally, there's a game. So At our party, we mix all those worlds, and I've always had a charitable component to it. So when we were in Miami and Haiti was suffering from cholera problems after an earthquake, we took a water machine and shipped it from the party to Haiti that could save 140,000 people by giving them purified water. When we were in to highlight the climate change issue, we greened up our party in Phoenix, and Governor Napolitano came and released an endangered hawk into the wild. And incidentally, I have a initiative called the Sporting Green Alliance, which takes sustainable technology in wind, solar, recycling, resurfacing, and water, integrates it into the grid of stadia, arena, and practice fields at high school, college, and pro level to drop carbon emissions and energy costs and to transform those buildings into educational platforms so the millions of fans go can see a waterless urinal, see a solar panel, think about what to put with that in their own homes and businesses. So this year we're doing a live uplink between the party and troops in the field in Afghanistan, where I'll be Oprah Winfrey and some of the celebrities can interact with them and bring some joy in their life because they're all big football fans. And we're one of the things we're raising money for is the Navy SEAL Foundation. So you're having a party, but at the same time, you're still aware of real-world conditions.
Kickoff Sunday night, you'll be where?
If I don't have players in the game, I'm not going to the game. So all those years where Steve Young and Troy Aikman and Ben Roethlisberger and Desmond Howard and all of them were MVPs, I was there. But this one will be the last one that I probably watch from the safety of my home.
And we should say warmth of your home, because it's going to be cold.
I spent the week on book tour last week in New York. So imagine, now I'm a Californian, and it was 80 degrees, and I get back there, and they're in the midst of a polar vortex.
Yeah.
And it's 8 degrees. And snow drifts and all that. Now, I know people in different parts of the country have experienced that before, but it was a shock to my system. So I don't think I have to prove my courage in any other way.
Lee Steinberg's new book is The Agent, My 40-Year Career Making Deals and Changing the Game. It is published by Thomas Dunn Books, a division of St. Martin's Press. Lee Steinberg, we wish you all the luck in the world. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book is The Agent, published by Thomas Dunn Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.